Welcome to Grimshaw Speakers, a partnership between the Grimshaw Club and the Beaver Sound. We bring you conversations with exceptional individuals discussing the issues of our times.
Today we speak with Ewan Healy and Gabriel Hedengren of Europe Elects about instant election data informing through social media.
This is a recording from our annual Grimshaw Symposium. Enjoy.
Welcome everyone. We're very fortunate today to have two speakers from Europe Elects with us. So Europe Elects, just to give a bit of background, was founded in 2014 by master students and provides poll aggregation and data analysis concerning elections occurring across Europe, both national and European elections. Both real-time data as well as projected data for elections which have yet to take place. And it operates across social media, I think with its main focus on Twitter and YouTube, but also Instagram, Snapchat, LinkedIn. So today we have with us Gabriel, who's in charge of covering the polls and elections for Sweden for Europe Elects. And we also have Ewan, who's kindly come all the way from Glasgow, who is editor-in-chief of Europe Elects. He's a freelance journalist, photographer, and a public speaker, and specializes in UK and EU government, politics, and elections. So if you could help me give our speakers a warm welcome today.
Thanks very much. Thanks so much for coming. We really appreciate it. So if you said, my name's Ewan. I'm the editor of Europe Elects. So my responsibilities with the team is I sort of coordinate our editorial stuff. So anything you read on the website, that's sort of come from the team that I help run. And I also help and support others in covering whatever country needs covering at any point in election in any kind of election cycle. So just how many of you have heard of Europe Elects before? About half. That's good. It means I can explain it and you guys won't already know what I'm talking about. We're a continent leading polling aggregation firm which does election data driven analysis across the EU 28 and beyond. Our main goal is information accessibility and then just sort of some general nerdiness, which we enjoy the data. And that's why, sort of a large part of why we do it. We were founded in 2014, and actually, to correct your entry, we weren't founded by master students. We were founded by a single master student called Tobias. Tobias is our founder and continues to lead us fiercely into the breach. We're a team of volunteers who work pro bono for Europe Elects. Intention is to grow and see more growth in that area. So we have a social media following of about 115,000 followers across platforms, ranging from sort of lightly interested political followers interested in their own domestic politics through to avid political junkies in the academic and professional sphere. We're a trusted source for European data analysis, breaking news and poll reporting. So I'm just going to walk through. What I thought I'd do is I'm just going to walk you through. Thanks. I'm just going to walk you through a little bit of how we try and do what we do in it, while holding on to our vision of being more joined up, modern, and inclusive. So I'm just going to move slightly to the side here. I think the first thing to acknowledge, especially talking in a symposium, talking about the changing face of international affairs, is that European politics and European society, economy, culture is more joined up than it's ever been before. And despite that, I think particularly in a country like the UK, we can see that the reporting of European affairs and European politics is terrible and has always been terrible. And it's improved slightly since the referendum in 2016, but I would say really not that much. And that's not just a sort of British story, but that's a story that exists across Europe. And there are lots of very good national reporting all across Europe, but the interrelation of national and international politics sometimes is a little bit worse for wear. This is the sort of, I guess, the point that where Europe Elects comes in is that we want to connect the politically minded in Britain with the politically minded in Poland, all discussing and talking about understanding elections in Malta. That's the theory, right? We want to connect people across the continent with elections that are going on in other countries and make sure people understand what's going on. And I think we think that this is essentially important because as Europe gets closer together, people need to have basic political literacy. And that's the aim of the game, right? So Yeah, so we aggregate public opinion. We do that using public opinion polling done by hundreds of polling firms across the EU28, beyond in 25 languages, in every member state. And we report the results, allowing as close as possible live coverage for people outside of the home country in English, which is the most accessible language in the European Union. In Europe, sort of a little tidbit. It wasn't actually the official language of the European Union, English, until the UK joined in the 70s, but it is intended to stay language of the core language of the European Union even after the UK leaves, because it is a more accessible translation language for the European Union. We're the largest company working to collate data on a holistic continental level, regurgitating the data as digestible a format as we can. And how we do that is through our charts and our social media platform, this lovely thing behind me. This is a British poll from the beginning of November, just the first one I could pull up from file. So the aim of the game is firstly, it's bright and colourful, easy to read, with a massive amount of information on this page, with whatever degree you access it from. Understandable. By labelling it, so this is the first thing, is the way that we essentially innovated in the polling industry to create accessible data across the European Union outside of home country, is to use national party European group affiliations next to the national party. So the European Parliament, there are a number of sort of groupings which are broadly ideological, connect countries from different parties from different countries after their election as MEPs. There are broad brushstroke measure, there are odd exceptions in each European Parliament group which don't quite fit the narrative. About sort of 99% of European parties can be described using this simple and understandable terms. So if we take Britain, for example, here, in our system, each of the parties is assigned to their appropriate European Parliament group. Conservatives, for example, member of the European Conservatives and Reformists group, take this dark blue colour. And you can see we do that for all of the countries, and we use this format, basically allows people in not the home country to understand who CON could be, right? I can just look at that using my knowledge of the ECR group's ideology and go, actually, which we also provide as explainers down the bottom here, that it's a National Conservative grouping, right? I can see that there's a National Conservative Party, a Social Democratic Party, a Liberal Party, a Green or Regionalist Party working down there. And we also, for parties without formal affiliations, we use sort of denoting things describing which direction they would go. So Change UK down in the corner on a little lowly 0%, having a hard time this election, I think. Down there, we basically broke the story of what, if elected in the European Parliament, where their MEPs would join. Alas, as you all know, there were no Change UK MEPs were elected in the European Parliament elections. But I'll leave that to others to explain why. But they were going to join the Renew Europe group, which is the sort of liberal democratic group, de facto led by Emmanuel Macron. There was the Women's Equality Party here, who we broke the news that they intended to join up with the Socialists and Democrats group in the European Parliament, with the Feminist Initiative Party of Sweden. I just want to show this example again for a country that you might know less about the politics of, just to show you how this can make it more accessible. So if you just move on to the next slide, it'd be great. So this is a poll that came out last week for Ireland. If I ask you just from nothing to describe just what FG or FF might mean, I think that doesn't tell you anything, right? So if I just reported a poll which said FG or FF, you wouldn't have any idea politically or ideologically who that would be, or whether they were in government or anything like that. So what we have here is we can use FG with the EPP grouping, so that they are a centre-right group. So that's Fine Gael, the party of Leo Varadkar, the Taoiseach of Ireland, Fianna Fáil, Sinn Féin, as you can see, work down. You can find out whatever you want about each of those political parties in turn. This model has been used by others. The acronym and uniform colour-based reporting is now used quite widely in Europe, and we consider ourselves to be the people who sort of created that model. And various polling sites and reporting companies have used similar chart styles after we launched ours. And I think the truth is that in a continent where the polls tell us that people feel and are more European, and as news stretches more frequently across softening borders, people need competent and understanding political reporting between different countries, and that we want to be able to report to people in a way that doesn't talk down to them, but they don't need an IR degree to understand. And on top of that, our text-based media reporting is really core to what we do, and that's provided by our team following news media correspondents in over 20 countries, recording and following news media in their domestic country to report domestic news to the European sphere. So we have, because there are, in multiple, every language of the European Union. So we use short and accessible breaking news tweets, which are on the next slide, here to just basically inform about changes in poll news. So just looking at this, you can immediately tell who the FPO are, what party grouping they are, political ideology, and how they're doing in the polls, right? The FPO down 40%, which is a historic or close to the low of, just over 10 years in Austria. So I can immediately follow that more easily, even if I don't avidly follow the Austrian political sphere. I can follow that in a much more accessible way. The second thing, obviously, is just reporting of changes in groupings. Group news here from Latvia, which I think, unless there are any Latvians in the room, I'd be very surprised if any of you knew anything about Latvian politics. But from this tweet, you can glean various things about the changes in Latvian domestic politics. On top of this, the party, we create party videos which walk through before an election, who's running an election, key pledges, that kind of thing, and then a little bit of history about each party. We've got one for the UK coming, and I've been working quite hard on creating a script for that. And let me tell you that trying to explain the nuances of Northern Irish politics to people who aren't British is not as easy as it sounds. So that's been, without using any UK-centric words, has been a challenge. In Europelex Towers, but we have got something that's being recorded at the moment, and we're going to be hopefully ready to go for the election soon. And I think, just to finish up, what I'm going to say is that what matters in international affairs, in poll reporting, in what we do, is our work being radically accessible. That's the aim of the game, is radical accessibility in a way that political reporting in the UK and abroad is not. And I think what I mean by that is it's very easy for political journalists, people in the Brussels bubble, people in the Westminster bubble, people who have IR and politics degrees, to talk about politics in a way which is really inaccessible. But what we want to do is we want to create the maximum accessibility. And we want what we create to be read and consumed by both experts, because we don't want to patronise people, we don't want to talk down or water down what we have to say, but we also want it to be understood by your mother. And that means even if it's the case with us, with a lot of our followers, is that English isn't your first language. And so that creates in itself challenges. And I think, as we do this and come together as a continent more closely, and that's the great challenge of the European Union, right, is that we need to create content which is accessible to people with varying degrees of English ability and also varying degrees of political knowledge and ability. So the European angle on national politics must also be related to people's lives, and so through our textual analysis, characterization of heads of state, not just as heads of state but also members of the European Council, we relate the national politics to the international politics, to the continental politics, which are becoming increasingly important, understanding themselves as a cog, as in a wider international political sphere. And so what that allows us to do is to track the rise and fall of ideologies across Europe over time. And we, if you go onto our website, you can see our polling trackers, and you can watch real time the rise and fall of the Green Surge, or the fall of the Social Democrats in Europe, or the rise of the far right, or whatever you want to track. But because we do it across the European sphere, we don't do the reactionary thing which national media tends to do, which is pick up one story from one election and say, look, this is the far right, they're everywhere, when really there's something lackluster about that and you miss out on something. That's most of what I have to say. We report democracy, and I suppose that's the only other thing I'll say, but you're going to talk about Hong Kong. So I'll pass on to Gabriel.
I'm Gabriel. I'm the contributor for Sweden at Europe Elects. And as unsurprisingly, I guess I love politics and I love polls. I really think that there is something about polls, love them or hate them. They sort of exist at the center of, various spheres of how we consume and how politics works in society. So I guess political parties obviously love them, both internally and how they inform their campaigning, but also to use to sort of amp themselves up and talk down their opponents. Obviously academics, we love polls and election data for our research and for analyzing long-term trends. Obviously voters, not everyone, but a lot of voters like to follow polls too, especially those inclined to vote more tactically. And finally, obviously, media loves polls because it makes it easy to make sort of, buzzy headlines and quick commentary that we're part of also, even though we try, our goal is to put it into context and make it easily accessible. I'm a relative newcomer to Europe Elects, so I only joined about a month before this year's European elections. So I was a follower and a fan, actually. I was on my bus here in London scrolling through, and I saw they needed someone to cover Sweden. So as Ewan says, we have a big team now. It didn't used to be the case where we all have a focus on a specific region or group, and they needed someone for Scandinavia. I emailed Tobias, our founder, and within a week I was publishing polls, election data, turnout statistics, it's been very exciting ever since. And yeah, I guess the European Parliament election of this year sort of was a culmination of, from 2014, the 5 years of building Europe Elects. And I think we're at a quite a good stage leading up to the campaign, having a big team, being able to publish a lot of content around that time. So you'll see this is just on May 26th, the day of the election, we published 488 tweets. We had a 2% engagement rate, which sounds low, but for social media is very high. We got 55,000 likes, 29,000 retweets, and a lot of replies too, and 19 million impressions. This was obviously thrilling for all of us to get so much traction and flooding everyone's Twitter feeds that week. And as I said, this would have been impossible without having this team. So as we're 39 people now, based on 4 continents, and covering all member states. And I guess a point I wanted to make is there are many critiques to be made about social media and sort of political communication in our current context. But for us, we see that this type of international cooperation and information sharing would have been so much harder a decade ago, almost impossible 2 decades ago. So we're still very positive about social media, even though there are very legitimate critiques of it too. And I guess our most unique, we love geeking out with these sort of graphics as well. So you'll see on the 29th of May, this is sort of an illustration of the Twitter buzz and what was talked about. The different colors represent different countries, different languages rather. So you'll see that the sort of two hubs of political discussion in Europe on the May 26th was Greta Thunberg, my fellow Swede, and Europe Elects. So you'll see that we're sort of the blue, I believe, is English. So we tilt, 20% of our followers are UK based, the rest is European. So that's why we're a bit in the blue, I imagine. I believe the yellow is Germany. So Germany obviously also had a huge green surge during that time, which I assume plays into part of why Greta Thunberg was such a hot topic that day, especially during that period. It just shows that where we are now is that we are followed by a lot of politics geeks and journalists. I'm not an expert.
This is every tweet that was made on the 29th of March, done with any of the European election hashtags in any of the languages in Europe, was mapped on this. And every line connection, they're very small on this, you can't really see, but every line connection between every point is a retweet, is a connection, the interaction between two different people. And so that means that we as Europe Elects were dragged into the middle because we were dragged out in all languages, and we're the largest name on there because we were the most retweeted account alongside Greta Thunberg during those elections. Explain it.
So moving on, our most unique feature is our e-currency projection, which I guess is the next slide. So this is basically compiled monthly now based on all published opinion polls across all EU countries. So obviously they're picked up by our whole team and entered into our database by us, and then analyzed by some of our more statistically expertised members. And then we come up with a prediction, a projection that looks sort of like this. So as you'll see, there have been some changes since May, but the big one is sort of the collapse of the Brexit Party and sort of the surge of the Conservative Party since then would be the main one. Sort of a slowdown of the green wave since then that I believe continues until now. But yeah, so this is sort of our most unique feature. And I mean, this what's cool about it is that not only do we accumulate a lot of valuable data that sits in our database that we know that we'll be able to use going forward as well, but it also gives us the opportunity to report in a very holistic way about European politics, which, as Ewan says, is something that happens sort of in the lead up to European elections every 5 years, and then after that, there's usually just a cutoff of that sort of reporting in the individual countries. So we see ourselves as being that sort of constant voice in this space, even when it's the interest of mainstream media sort of goes down, but we remain as the reporters of this throughout, well, constantly. But then, on the other hand, having a growing team and having so many subject area experts join from all over Europe also means that we can cover individual elections in a more comprehensive way too. So yes, that's the next slide. So obviously, with being a bigger team, we can do this more and more since it takes quite a lot of time. But these are just some examples from just October and November of various events that we've covered that have gone quite well. So you'll see that we do everything from mayoral elections, you'll see there in Budapest, which was quite monumental because the opposition party's mayoral candidate won there. We did the regional elections in Thuringia, which we got a lot of interaction there because the Liberal Party basically passed the threshold with like 6 votes in the region. So we sort of live reported that. I believe that was twice we did that. Then we had the general election in Poland that got a lot of traction. And then we also play around a lot with maps, and we follow the live counting of votes by constituency, and then we try more and more to create graphics. We came up with this funny one, which you see the blue is the Law and Justice Party, which is the right-wing governmental party, and then the Civic Coalition is red, and then you can see that the level of support sort of weirdly matches the border of Prussia in 1848, so I guess there's like a regional. Obviously, we're not making, this is not a master's project, so it had to be tested further. But yeah, that's just something we spotted and shared that got a lot of traction, which I guess says something about the East-West divide in Poland. But yeah, we'll get into that in any more detail. And then finally there, one of the most recent major elections was the second general election in Spain this year. And then you'll see there the map of the poor citizens party that did very badly. And then you can see on our map there, it sort of illustrates how they lost basically across all of Spain. And I guess for each of these teams, we really have had, for each of these campaigns, we've had a small team that's been able to plan in advance, follow the polls closing in real time, which has, you know, helped us a lot in terms of attracting people. And then I guess in this space, we compete with mainstream publications in each country covering these elections. And I think especially for countries outside, and it will usually just be a lot of the big publications that will have correspondents covering this ongoingly. So we also here see it as a way for people maybe in regions where certain, like the mayoral election in Budapest might not be covered broadly in the media they follow nationally, they can follow us and get their information in that way. And I guess to finish off, we are in a position currently to expand our coverage. So apart from the EU28, we cover non-EU countries like Switzerland this fall, also other European countries, not so democratic ones. We covered the elections in Belarus earlier this fall too, which gave us some quite funny charts of, you know, basically 100% for one party and zero for the other, and that sort of thing. And this does also raise some questions, I guess, for us, and also why we're relevant, because when you cover countries that are questionably democratic, and especially also now that we expand outside of Europe, it means that we have a bigger responsibility, and the work we do becomes more normative and explicitly political, I guess, in a certain sense. So while our overall approach is to remain neutral and sort of stick to the way in which we report things and make sure that it's the same across the board, this obviously has limits, and we want to make sure that we represent democracy and that we're explicit in when there are any issues, when there are questions about the legitimacy of a result, etc., that we report on that too. This is an example from Italy. So basically what's happening is that we have America Elects and Asia Elects. They're sort of emerging now as side platform stars. And we did very well covering the district, the council elections in Hong Kong this week and last week. So this is one of our most popular posts ever of the results, the seat results in the district council elections in Hong Kong. And yeah, it was really great because we got a lot of interaction, a lot of positive feedback from people in Hong Kong and campaigners there. So we really like to see that. And something that we want to continue doing going forward. And I guess I can just back up what Ewan said earlier. We just think there's such a value in trying to understand political developments in countries other than your own, and social media offers an extremely compelling way of doing so, because we can make sure that this information is integrated into people's overall feeds, so drip feed information over time to people, which hopefully, if they follow us, they'll over time learn more and more about other countries and what's going on there. And in spite of what many, I think, movements in Europe currently want to try and portray in terms of nationalist movements and things like that, even they are becoming more and more similar and more cooperative on a European level. So I think basically across the board, there needs to be more European level analysis of what's going on in Europe. I think that sums up sort of our approach and what we do.
Fantastic.
Thanks very much.
No, thank you very much for a very informative presentation. So I have a couple of questions, and then hopefully this will give those in the audience who need a bit of time to formulate one, if they have one, a bit of time to reflect and do that, and then we'll open it up to the floor. So I just wanted to ask, you talked about your projections and sort of talked about the centrality of that to your project, particularly pertaining to the European elections. Have there ever been instances where you've come up with a projection off of the data, off of the polls, and then the actual voting patterns have diverged massively from what was predicted, or do you tend to be pretty spot on?
So the projections are fairly new to the project, probably the last 12 months or so, particularly because they were sort of launched for the first time, just some proper data analysis, projecting for the European Parliament elections last year, earlier this year even. No. That's the answer. Our projection, not to brag, but our projection was the most accurate of all of the European media organisations that were creating projections, or one of the most accurate. We did a bit of analysis, and I can dig it out at some point. But the at the time of whose projection was the closest when it came to the actual election, and I think ours was the most accurate on most of the groups. Others, I mean, Professor Simon Hicks's was also very, very good, very, very close. And he uses that data, so what's not to love?
Yeah. I think for most of them, I was looking earlier, it was, between 1, 5, 10 seats per group, which obviously, if you think about all the data from all the various countries, so many different parties to monitor, and hundreds of seats in the parliament.
Yeah, and especially on a for 750 seats across 28 countries, the mistakes might have been more significant on a national level as a proportion of seats. And I think, there are a couple of cases where we under or overestimate parties in particular countries. But on the continental level, we work with. I think actually what will be one to watch is our British Parliament projection, which we've got currently rolling, and that is. First past the post is an evil master. And so trying to project for the UK is very, very difficult. And we will probably be wrong. I'll probably say that. But
it's fun anyway.
I have another question as well. Given the amount of data analysis that you do, do you believe that the level of concern surrounding the rise of the far right in Europe is representative of the truth, or do you think that's been skewed largely? You touched on this slightly earlier.
I studied this as well when I was at LSE. I did my master's here. I think what's been a bit skewed is, I guess, there's this narrative, obviously, of a unified rise across the continent, which I think in one way, if you look at it very long term, is true. But then when you actually look at country by country data, you realize that it's so different in each country. And certain parties, you know, have boosts and then fall. So I think it's definitely a theme and a narrative, something to monitor, but it's way less straightforward than many media, I would say, reports. There are also many differences between far-right parties in Europe, depending on where they originate from, who they cooperate with, how they relate to each other, the degree to which they become mainstream in their countries and how that changes them. You have to, in my opinion, also separate then the ideological discussion of what is Europe, what is nationalism, what is, like, how do we work to counteract that on a European level, national level, and then discussing the actual political events and how they might differ.
And that's exactly right, in the sense that we have different meanings of different, like, the word nationalism, the word fascism, the word far right means a very different thing in all 28 European countries. And so when the media in this country particularly really enjoys reporting on the rise of the far right, and it's just a sort of in a slightly smug, we don't have that here, far right rise thing, which the problem is we sort of report these, we report all elections in Europe like they're majoritarian, and that's what it is. We have a majoritarian electoral system here, and we report proportional elections like they're majoritarian. And that's a serious problem, because we talk about the, you know, you look at, you say, oh, the far right surge in X or Y country, and really what they've done is they've deemed 30% of the vote. Which yes, obviously, they are the largest party, they have a plurality, but they are by no means a majority. You have different definitions of what far right means. I mean, there are reasonable arguments to be made that far right parties exist in the European People's Party, the European Conservatives and Reformists, and in the Identity and Democracy Group, all three right wing groups. And you know what? There were in the past people talking about Cinque Stelle, the Five Star Movement in Italy, as a Five Star Movement, as a far right movement. And things have radically changed within the party, but also in a national level, where once you've seen like Brothers of Italy, or you've seen Matteo Salvini, you know, M5S don't look so far right anymore. And so I think the media loves it. That's the thing. The media loves all the far right surging in Europe. Yeah. They love it. They love that narrative. But it is true. There is an uptick. But I don't know. I think they like the story.
It's also that, for me, it's that it's not the only thing happening. So I think a lot of it is like, you'll have journalists, they will jump, they will be like, this election's happening, send someone to this region to report on it, then they write one piece about just the far right party that might gain 4 or 5 points, but then they don't report on a rise of the Green Party or a rise of the far left party, and like the complexities of that country's sort of development, or maybe even like how the government's formed there. So I think it's, what's important is to sort of cover it more broadly, because there's other things happening in Europe than just the rise of far right.
Absolutely. I mean, look at the,
it's a serious issue.
Absolutely. I mean, look at the sort of Thuringia regional elections in East Germany, or former East Germany, just last month. The media was awash with reports of the far right rise. The AfD was the first time they'd become the largest party in a region, but the second largest party was underreported. There's the Die Linke, the sort of radical left wing successor party to one of the successor parties to the East German Communist Party, rose to be the second largest party, and it's sort of a very unreported story. And I think I think political ideology, political framework in Europe is changing, and the media is a little bit confused about how to report about it. So,
thank you. So maybe we can open this up to questions from the audience. Does anyone have one?
I have two questions. quick one, sorry. First of all, I just want to say, as somebody who's very bad at understanding graphs, Europe like was saving grace in the elections. I'm not gonna lie.
I'd like to hear it.
So my two questions are, at first, this might be a bit of a silly question, but when you have such vast amounts of data, where do you start to even accumulate it to create this very easy to understand graphics? And then secondly, you said in the first graph you showed with UK parties, national parties, and being linked to a European party affiliation, do you think that on a national level it could actually help to create more of a pro-European sentiment as people are becoming more aware of their affiliation within the EP?
Yeah. I mean, how we start, so, I mean, I think the database has built up over time.
Yeah.
As I said, it does help. So basically, various people monitor specific polls, and are responsible for entering it into our system. I'm not in charge of the actual sort of IT maintenance of it. So I don't know how complicated that actually is. I just enter data into the system.
All our data is open source.
I think it's a team effort, and then it's open source.
If you're really into data, you can go on our website. If you go onto europelect.eu/any country in the European Union, you can go there and you can download historic polls for any European country, and you can enjoy that data to your heart's content. We're just a data entry. That's just a data entry exercise, but then from there, you can do way more analysis, and then also on the regional level from that kind of data entry point. And then we have very clever people who work on projections using swings, and I'm not a data journalist. I'm not a numbers person. I'm a writer. I don't really understand it, but I just do what I'm told. Philip, who's our team lead on the data analysis, is very, very talented. And
And when it comes to the EP Parliament groups, I do think it might lead to people becoming a bit more pro-European. I think it also helps to sort of remind people that they exist. ongoingly, so I think usually when after you have the parliament election, most of the focus on EU politics are on the more, I guess, more powerful players, so the council and all these sort of big figures that everyone knows of in the EU that, you know, will lead the negotiations and so forth. So I think a lot of people don't think about the work that goes on in the EU parliament within these groups. And I think also one thing that you realize also in the lead up to the EU elections is the fact that people need to think more of those groups also than the national parties they vote for. Because sometimes you say they are so broad, so even though maybe you're voting for, so maybe a party that you support in your country that might be quite centered, right, might be quite a weak party in, I don't know, ECR or a group in the European Parliament, which is more controlled by nationalist conservative groups.
Yeah.
So then if you vote for the party you support nationally to send an MEP there, that will actually contribute to giving the group in Parliament that power that you might not agree with. So I think that's the main aim of it. And hopefully I think people just being exposed to EU politics more will make them more positive towards it, because it's not something new.
Yeah, I mean that's absolutely
sure
right.
That answer.
And I just think that literacy on European politics and the operations of the European Union in this country is very low because reporting is so bad, and I think people don't understand. And you know, I've done this when I was so in the European election, I went followed around some door knockers for one of the political parties to just sort of hear on the doorstep what voters were saying. To their campaigners, and essentially people, you know, campaigners are people who are actively involved in the operations of political parties, asking questions about, well, when we elect our MEPs, do they actually vote? Like, what happens in the European Parliament? People don't actually understand, and I think that is so widespread across, British society, and people just don't have a grasp of it. And I think part of what this does is it allows people to understand that they are a cog in the wider European parliament machine, and you understand where they fit into that story. Because, you know, when we elect, I don't know, when the Conservative Party send their three Conservative MEPs, three out of 750 is nothing, but they are part of the 92 strong, 91 yeah. strong ECR group. Don't check me on those numbers. and so that's where they come in, and they are, you know, they support leaders and vote for committee members from their party who tend to be from the Law and Justice Party in Poland, and because of the size of that delegation. Hope that answers your question.
Yeah, I'm
going to
say kind of more of a functional question. You have the sort of incredible niche that you're dominating here and really very successfully. I'm amazed that you're still run by volunteers. So my question is really related to what's the future of EuropeElects with this growth and success, particularly this year. Are you looking to be less volunteer based? How are you going to sustain the organisation?
That's the long-term goal. Yeah, and when we know, we'll let you know. But we currently work as a volunteer base, and people give as much as they can. We all work in various academic and professional spheres, and that has its benefits and its drawbacks.
We are thinking about it, and I guess we would all love for it to become a more formalized thing that we can dedicate ourselves to full time.
Yeah.
So, you know, we have some working groups discussing ideas for, you know, how to maybe enter some sort of partnerships or how to register, like those are early stage.
Yeah. There are options on the table, and there's a lot going on, and that's great. And we've got some new cool revenue receptive projects coming soon, which will be fun, but yeah, the best thing to do to support our work is to follow us on Twitter and just retweet everything.
Can I just follow up on that question? Because you are so open source and you're dispensing information in such an excellent way, have you had any copycats by any chance? Is someone seeing that you're successful in this sphere, and have you noticed that other groups are kind of doing a similar thing?
There are others who do similar things to what we do. No one as successfully and no one as largely as us. Obviously no one could be us, though someone out there has the EuropeElects @EuropeElects Twitter handle, which is infuriating. So if you want to find that, you have to find EuropeElige in Spanish. I think that's how you pronounce it, speak Spanish. You have to find that. But beyond that, that's that's what we do.
Okay.
There are others. No one like us.
What about Politico? Politico Paul of Paul.
That's one of the others.
Yeah.
That's as good as us.
So it's not you.
That's not us. That's
right.
Not us.
Okay.
They do exist. We have. We know them. We know the guys who run that project.
Do they know you?
Yes. Yeah. No, we have a working relationship with them.
Okay.
Yeah, that's all right. Yeah, our graphs are better than this.
No, it's funny, yeah, because I didn't know about you, but Politico is, I think, doing quite a good thing in terms of aggregating those polls.
So Polopols started independently of Politico, and then Politico sort of bought Polopols.
Oh, really?
And it's only been Politico Polopols for 8 months.
Okay.
Yeah, it was in the lead
just
up
in the lead up
to
the last European election. In the same way that you'll have noticed if you follow BritainElects that they are now New Statesman BritainElects.
Okay.
On their website.
So someone might buy you at some moment.
they try.
Okay.
We're open to hearing all offers if you're listening on the podcast. we're get in touch.
Okay, I had a question. First, I wanted to know, it's interesting that you are also reporting data, for instance, from Belarus, which is, I think you should be brave enough to call it non-democratic state.
Yeah.
I think it's all right. And also to recognize that there are actually no elections, and no international observer recognized those elections as free and fair. So it's like, I think it's also good to note to your visitors that in case of that country, you just report, or any other countries like that, you just report something else but elections.
We, if you go on our feed and you go on and you scroll down to the Belarusian coverage on our feeds, you will see that we report very clearly that it is a sub-democratic election.
That's true. Yeah.
And you will see that with one particular photo we shared from a journalist of the view that international observers had of people counting votes, which is a line of backs of people, and then they're sort of counting on the desk in front of them, and the observers are sitting there behind them looking at people's backs while they count votes.
Yeah.
See what I mean?
That's exactly what it
and
is.
You see that on our feed. We are Democrats, right? And we have something of a, you know, as all political journalists do, we have something of a sort of democratic watchdog role in the process.
But in that regard, I have an idea for your future sub-project. You might go into reporting elections in China or in North Korea and united in something else, something like non-election sub-project. But I had another question. Do you use API to harvest your data? And if you do, how you do it? Does any country provide API style access to election data, for instance?
Good question. Can I give you my email address? and we can talk about this. I don't cover the data stuff.
Okay.
But we do use API.
Uh-huh.
I think.
Okay.
We do use API. In terms of what different countries provide, that's a really interesting thing. I could write a lot about that and talk a lot about the different way that different countries report and like government reports their own elections and data they provide. And I'd have to get back to you. I don't know whether the answer to your question about whether any countries provide API.
Uh-huh.
But we collect polling data for non electoral events, so like just general polling,
uh-huh.
privately funded. We collect ourselves.
Like, for instance, an example.
So the two polls that I showed there, we collect them from the data from whoever commissions the poll. We report it and enter it into our database manually.
Okay.
Well, thanks first for the talk. And I was wondering about how you collect the data through social media. So in the presentation, you had the European Parliament hashtags. And I was wondering whether you thought social media and the data you collected could show any more of an outreach. So, for example, just like thinking about data from social media, there seems to be more and more it can show someone's opinion, but at the same time, there's a lot of discrepancies in the data. Not only is there like an absence of a question being put forward, but also, it's very almost unreliable in the sense of questions. The answers are quite broad, it's difficult to sort of collect something quite focused. So in that sense, are there challenges in terms of collecting data through that way, and can it show anything more specific?
Just for those who didn't hear, that was to do with data collection and its accuracy within social media.
So that chart that we showed on the side of the screen there, that wasn't created by us, it's created by a journalist called Luca Hammer, which we should have put on the thing, so that's apologies, but you can't see that on the podcast, so you don't know. It said Luca Hammer on the slide. A very talented data journalist. And there are, I think the data that you get from social media is all about the question that you ask of it. And there are things that social media can show you, and there are things that social media can't show you. And we actually have to be very careful about that. And all that information there showed us is that we were at the heart of a multilingual European Parliament election discussion. But it doesn't necessarily show who we were reaching that wasn't already talking about it. It doesn't answer that question. I'm not 100% sure whether that answers your question, what quite you were getting at.
Just a really good question. I'd asked already about your future, but I wanted to actually think about your origin. Obviously, we are students ourselves and do our own initiatives like this one and symposium, so it's really exciting to see something which reaches this height from a student. I was wondering if you could kind of elaborate a bit more about what you know of kind of Tobias's motivation for doing this, and you laid out incredible principles for how you represent data and real active choices that you made, which led to your success. So if you could kind of break down why it was that Tobias went into this, and you know, did he see kind of this was a gap in a desire, something in demand by people who want to be informed about selection data?
Well, I think he, since for the first few years, it was just him.
First 3 years,
I believe he was just in his bedroom, sort of like a lot of us that follow these things do, just following the stats in different countries on his own.
Yeah.
And was like, I can't see anyone posting it, so he posted whatever he could.
Yeah.
And then that already got traction, I guess, quite quickly before any of this was sort of formalized. And then I think it's been like 5 years.
Mm-hmm.
So I think it's been bit by bit, trial and error.
Yeah, I think trial and error is definitely, there's a big part of it that is mistakes we've made and things that we've reported wrong. For example, in one of our early projections for the previous European Parliament election, we projected that the Democratic Unionists might get 2 MEPs when they were only running 1 candidate, right? Things like that we made mistakes and we corrected them as soon as we could, but we are imperfect volunteers and so we make mistakes. And I think, but when Tobias started it, he did so because there was a gap in the market. There was no one reporting holistically on pan-European polling of any kind. No one was talking about the interconnection of polling across the borders, and it just sort of grew from there. And I joined the team with the sort of first influx of sort of staff team members in 2017, so about 2 years ago this month. And we've grown so much since then. When I joined, we'd have been shy of 50,000, and now we're looking longingly at 150,000. We were only on Twitter. We've expanded to Facebook, Instagram, YouTube. We are professionalized now in a way that we weren't when I first joined. The charts are all new and things like that. And I think,
I think it was really key because I guess Tobias hit a point where it hit his personal limit of what he could do with it, sort of reached. And I don't know the details of his past, but I believe he was in Kenya.
He's lived in a lot of different countries. He's been reporting European polling from Tanzania while he was living in Tanzania for a year, and he spent time living in Uganda and Israel, and he's from Germany originally, now lives in Canada. And so sort of, if you imagine someone who manages to get himself around as much as he does, you can imagine that there is a personal limit of what you can cover. And I feel like I hit my personal limit, and I'm just one cog in a sort of 14-member team, and I hit my personal limit of coverage. So I don't know how Tobias managed to spend 4 years doing this alone, but...
So it was an important step, I think, for you, but that's when you made that decision to sort of open up a bigger team.
Do we have a final question?
As I think about you use social media as a way to connect everyone together, but sort of recently we have seen sort of the negative side of social media when it comes to, even just from the UK general election campaign, how things have been twisted and edited. Have you seen any sort of the negative impact of social media impacting your work or your popularity?
We have some lovely friendly followers who like to post lovely friendly things underneath polls that they don't like.
Yeah.
that happens. We are accused of being fronts for the far right and the far left. We're accused of being fronts for the centre, for the European Union, for the anti-European Union, for whoever you want. We are accused of being funded by all sorts of different people, various anti-Semitic tropes. We're part of the political sphere, and it's just what Europe is like at the moment. And you will know from your own experience of social media and politics that if people enjoy denying that polls are true when they don't agree with their own ideology. And don't get me wrong, polls make mistakes. Data is data, but. That said, I mean, it doesn't stop us from what we're doing. We're reporting news. People can process that however they want. People will process that however they want. There's nothing really you can do about that. We've got to make sure polls are true. We report true polls and not false ones, and we do look over polls carefully. We consider methodology very carefully of pollsters that are new when they appear. Not every country has as well-regulated polling industries as the UK's. Not every country has a sort of a British polling survey, a British polling council, you know, and so there are, you know, certain pollsters which we omit from our reporting because they are less than correct, we'll say that.
I mean, we don't do it from our official accounts, but sometimes I'm in our responses and replies answering questions, because, you know, when you work with polling, I mean, you are transparent, you know, there are always weird weaknesses of certain methodologies. You have certain polling firms that will be sort of biased towards a certain demographic and how they do their polls, and then we can answer that. I work with Sweden, obviously, and the big trend there is the Sweden Democrats, so I always have a lot of happy Sweden Democrats in my response. So it depends. It literally depends on what the poll says and who sort of interacts with it, and sometimes it takes off in one direction and sometimes in another.
Yeah, and you occasionally get, so we obviously, we get retweeted by various, you know, and we're followed by various political movers and shakers in Europe of all creeds and colours. I can't overstate that. And so that means when one of their, you know, if say Matteo Salvini, the former deputy prime minister of Italy, retweets one of our tweets, we get a lot of pro-Salvini followers with emotions in the comments. And that's just what happens. If Guy Verhofstadt retweets what we do with a comment, we get a lot of angry liberals in our comments. And so on and so forth. And whenever we post a poll, which, you know, for the UK, which relates to Jeremy Corbyn, we get a people with emotions for and against Jeremy Corbyn in the comments, and that is just the nature of political reporting.
Perhaps to wrap up, did you want to mention the podcast?
Well, we've now been, among the things that we are currently in development, we are soon to be launching. This is the first time we've ever mentioned it in anywhere official, so enjoy that moment of history. We are in development of a podcast, which Gabriel and I will be hosting, to be covering politics across the European Union. So when that comes, do follow us. And if you're not could just get the final slide up with just all the social media handles, because we are a social media industry operator. So you following us everywhere would be greatly appreciated. And supporting our work would be fantastic. And then that's mine and Gabriel's handles as well. If you want to stay.
If you ever have questions or, you know, things about what we post, like, we always respond to people, and people reach out to us, say, oh, I've seen this poll, can you publish it, and things like that. So, we're open.
Yeah, absolutely. DM me, email us. My email's actually not on there, but editor@europelects.eu. That's me. Yeah, and ask us any questions you have. Thanks for coming.
Well, thank you very much.
Many thanks to our speakers, Ewan Healy and Gabriel Hedengren. The wonderful music was by Ashley Lyle-Marsing. We hope you enjoyed the podcast. For more info on the Grimshaw Club and the Beaver Sound, check out our websites.